This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Perhaps no movie has stirred such controversy on aesthetics, on religion, and on history. Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ has opened to mixed reviews in all three areas. Powerful and moving, some critics say. Graceless and excessively violent, say others. Some religious leaders praise its reverent reflection of the Gospels. Others argue that it's a pastiche that distorts Christ's message. And while just about every scholar finds some historical inaccuracies, they divide over how important they are. There are also some critics who call the film anti-Semitic and some defenders who call critics anti-Christian. We're going to try to address the film on all those levels. If you've seen The Passion of the Christ, call now and tell us what you thought of it as a movie. We'll get into the religious and historical aspects a little bit later in the program. If you'd like to join the discussion, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now are two film reviewers with remarkably different views of this picture. David Denby is with us. He's a film critic for The New Yorker magazine. He joins us from his home in Manhattan. Good to have you with us.
Hi, glad to be here.
And with us from his office here in Washington, D.C. is Ramesh Panuru, a senior editor with The National Review, and thanks to you for you to joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
David Denby, you said at one point in your review, while you were watching the film, there was a point when you thought Gibson has lost his mind. What made you think that?
Because of the obsessive concentration, the fascination with the physical destruction of Jesus' body. I mean, everyone knows that Jesus suffered horribly the last 12 hours of his life. There's no debating that. The question is, how do you represent it? And Christian artists for about 1,000 years have been anguishing over precisely that question. And there is a minor strain in the high arts of showing the suffering in great detail. The Eisenheim altar by Matthias Grunewald is a masterpiece, and that certainly shows a very pained Jesus. But the main line of representation through the Renaissance and certainly the moderns has been to concentrate less destruction of a body because of the dangers of fascination and the sadomasochistic elements in that, and more on the meaning of Jesus' sacrifice and redemption. And the body is just a column of light, say, in paintings by Goya, who was certainly not afraid of dismemberment, showed it again and again in his art. So here you have a movie that is essentially, after the preliminaries, about a handsome, strapping young man slowly tortured to death. And you see things in slow motion, blow after blow after blow. I am not exaggerating. The flaying and scourging goes on, which is only one line, or in Matthew, Mark, and John, goes on for 10 or 12 minutes. Then the Stations of the Cross with Christ is beaten again and again and collapses, and then the hammering of the nails into his hands during the crucifixion. This is madness. And how a 10-year-old is going to respond to this and then be told it's a spiritual and religious experience when it's very, very disturbing, I don't know.
Well, it's an R-rated movie. Ramesh, you liked it a lot. Tell us why.
Well, I did like it. I found it profoundly moving. But I should say that I agree with David Denby on one point quite strongly, and that's the point with which he ends his review in The New Yorker, which is this is not a film for children. I would think very seriously before I brought a child to this movie. I also agree, you know, all of the things that that David said about the historical tradition of Christian art, I think are quite right. This is a movie that is really drenched in blood, and you can certainly question the dramatic and even the theological choices that Gibson made. But I think that they're also defensible choices. That is to say, you know, this movie is filled with blood, but we know the main character tells us in a flashback his blood is life. You know, I mean, I think there's a theological meaning to a lot of the choices that Gibson made, you know, and people may dislike that theology, but I do think that you know it's not sort of simply a decision to drench the movie mm-hmm. in gore to run up the box office numbers or something like that. I mean, I don't think it's sort of a perverse thing. I think it's a very, very purposeful and in to my mind, I mean, if you are receptive to the message at least, it works.
How much are people going to be interested in theology when they're watching someone flayed to death? I mean, the spiritual moments in the movie, there are brief flashbacks to the Sermon on the Mount and the Last Supper. They're very brief. They have very little resonance. Jim Caviezel is not effective in a kind of charismatic way. And you're reading everything in subtitles because it's all spoken in Aramaic and the Romans speak Latin. Jesus' famous words, which, you know, are magnificent for all of us, Christians and non-Christians, are barely on the screen. And the star of the show is Mel Gibson, the visual artist, rather than the message of Jesus, which is inspiring to me, even though I'm not a Christian.
Well, I would just say, if I may, a religious moment need not be a spiritual moment.
Yeah.
It's absolutely central to Christianity, the idea that God became flesh.
Right.
The fleshment of Christianity and the suffering of that flesh is one way, I think, of getting to that. I mean, that here was a man.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN@npr.org. And our first caller is Tom, who's with us from Tallahassee, Florida.
Hey, how are you?
Okay.
I think it's important that people realize that this is an activist film, and that those who don't like the message are not going to like the film, and that those who appreciate the message are going to go into the film and enjoy it. And no one's going to go to this film by accident and say, oh, wait a minute, I didn't know this was a film about Jesus being executed. I thought it was going to be peace and light. You know, it's well publicized what this movie is about. It's about the height of this person's life, the most unpleasant times. And, you know, I've noticed from people who have died from terminal diseases that there's a tendency that they could have lived a wonderful life, but if their last few weeks were unpleasant and painful, people just seem to think it was such a tragedy. But we all have to remind ourselves that the life of Jesus was more than just his execution, but that his execution was critical to what his life meant to us. And we also have to remember that this is like a Holocaust film. You know, not all Holocaust films or anti-Nazi films can be the Sound of Music. Some of them are going to be very unpleasant.
I've never seen a Holocaust film that of course, you know, Schindler's List is full of cruelty by Germans directed at Jews and many other Holocaust films. But I've never seen a film that feasted on the slow torturing to death of one person who's shackled. I mean, if two people are in a fight, then you can say, okay, it's, you know, the violence is watchable, but it's sadism when someone is shackled.
Have you seen Night and Fog?
See how that can become a spiritual message. I mean, and that's why. Look, here's the proof. Gibson said to Caleb Deschanel, his cinematographer, "I want this to look like Caravaggio, great artist from the early 17th century." Okay. And some of the shots do. But I went and looked at Caravaggio's paintings. He did a flagellation scene, which was a familiar genre scene for Italian Renaissance painters. And guess what? The body is virtually unmarked. Why? Because he, like Michelangelo, like Goya, like many others, these were not timid men. They knew the dangers of fascination with physical suffering and how that could divert one, the viewer, into very dangerous kinds of emotions that were not spiritual at all. And that's what's going on in this movie. I don't know how you cannot see that.
Well, how can you watch a film like Night and Fog and say that there are no Holocaust films that fascinate on the suffering of people? That's almost required viewing for high school.
You didn't hear what I said. Of course they're about the suffering of people, but they're about a generalized suffering, not the slow flaying to death of one man in close-up in slow motion.
But it's Jesus very represents different all technique. Of humanity. He isn't one man. He represents all of mankind. It's one man's sacrifice
but
for all of
mankind. But it's represented on film as one man. It's a strapping, half-naked young actor slowly destroyed. You're jumping to the metaphorical level.
That's correct. I am, and that's what the whole point of the film is.
Okay, Tom, well, thanks very much for the call, Tom. Appreciate it. And Ramesh, I wanted to ask you, do you find a divide between believers and non-believers in the reaction to the movie, and particularly the violence?
Well, I mean, sort of not just believers and non-believers, but different kinds of believers and different kinds of beliefs. There's no question that, unfortunately, in many respects, this has become sort of it's like a movie for the culture wars. It's half, half the public sort of decided it was for this movie and half the public decided it was against it. You almost get the sense before the movie came out and before anybody saw anything. And I think a lot of the reviewers, and doubtless including me, have sort of taken some of these prior thoughts and commitments to our viewing of the movie.
Let's see her now from Joseph, and Joseph is with us from Lafayette, New Jersey.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I believe that this film is personally difficult to compare with any other film because it's trying to portray what historically is the Son of God being crucified for man. And so if you take that one event in history, the one and only event in history, and try to compare it with anything else, I think you run into difficulty in and of itself because it's an incomparable thing in and of itself.
So it's a one-of-a-kind film, and certainly David Denby, I can't think of any other film that's been made in two dead languages.
No, that's true, but unfortunately, that distances us from Jesus's wisdom and his radiance and his fantastic personal power by reading subtitles from the Aramaic. Look, crucifixion was used by the Romans as a political device. The Romans were not interested in doctrinal disputes between different sects of Jews. What they were interested in was controlling Judea, ancient Israel, and they used it to deter. They turned it into a spectacle, the slow torturing to death of a human being in order to humiliate, right? It was a kind of, if you want, a kind of movie that they made. By taking all the spiritual meaning out of this thing, and the resurrection is nothing, it's just a second, Mel Gibson has in effect given the Romans their triumph and denied Christ his triumph.
Ramesh, it's certainly. What do you think of it as a piece of craft? How well is it made? Do you think?
You know, it's funny. I get this question. Stanley Fish wrote an essay once where he was talking about teaching his students Milton and throwing his hands up in frustration at one point, saying, "No, you don't understand. He doesn't want to entertain you. He doesn't want to hold your interest. He wants to save your soul." You know, and I sort of have the same feeling. You know, my friends who are not believing Christian who ask me, you know, well, is it entertaining? And so I was like, no. I mean, you'd have to be. I mean, David is right on this one. You'd have to be a complete sadist to find this movie, you know, entertaining. And I think that sort of, you know, and I think a lot of it will seem simply crazy to people who are not already religiously receptive. On the other hand, you know, if you do see it, and you do also see sort of some of the purposes he's trying to serve here, I think it's a beautifully, wonderfully done movie.
I think, Neil, I think the lighting by Caleb Deschanel is extraordinary. I do think it has a kind of grim, relentless power here and there. I don't think he's without skill, but we haven't even talked about the other issue, of course, which is anti-Semitism. And the problem is, as John Meacham very carefully laid out in his cover story in Newsweek 3 or 4 weeks ago, Gibson and his screenwriter have done a number of things to change the Gospels, A, and B, to ignore what historians know, in such a way as to collectively increase the Jewish responsibility for the crucifixion of Jesus and decrease the Roman responsibility. And the most striking thing is that the Jewish priests, who were under the thumb of Pontius Pilate, and Pilate was a terrible dictator who was constantly massacring Jews, the Jewish priests managed to manipulate and play Pontius Pilate in order to get him to do what they want, and that strikes historians as extremely unlikely.
We're going to be talking more about the Gospels and their history and the histories of their writers when we come back from a short break. David Denby, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Ramesh Panuru, we appreciate your time today, too.
Thanks.
I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the new movie, The Passion of the Christ. If you'd like to join our discussion, and we're shifting to a history of the Gospels at this point and how accurately the film reflects them, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Mel Gibson wove together the screenplay for The Passion of the Christ from the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which together tell what may be the most familiar story in the world. But what do we really know about these Gospels? Who wrote them exactly? When? And why? Are there more accounts beyond the four Gospels that we find in the New Testament? And what do we know about the people of Jesus' time and how they lived? Joining us now is Joanna Dewey, a professor of biblical studies specializing in the New Testament. She's academic dean of the Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and she joins us from her office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And let me begin by asking you, you've not seen the film, is that right?
That is correct.
As a scholar of the New Testament and first century Christians, though, what can you tell us about the people and the politics of the time? Well, for example, I mean, we see three Jews being crucified on one day. Was this a common punishment?
Oh, very common. In fact, there were times when an earlier king and the Romans regularly crucified small numbers. They also, at times, crucified hundreds or thousands. They used it as an instrument of terror, an instrument of deterrence, as a spectacle that was a brutal, but even more than that, a humiliating way of death. It was a shame to be crucified. Your family often would disown you if you were crucified. And the Romans used it quite literally as a deterrent.
Now,
they believed in preventative control of groups.
Not all Christians believe that the gospel accounts are literally accurate. If not, then how is it interpreted?
The Gospels are stories based on oral tradition from 40 to 70 years after the crucifixion of Jesus. Stories are adapted to new communities, shifting from an Aramaic language to Greek-speaking communities. Some of the early Christian communities were heavily Jewish. Some were quite mostly not Jewish, Gentile. So the story would get adapted to the needs of the individual communities. Finally gets written down around 70 for the earliest and 80, 90, 100 for the later Gospels. Mm-hmm. And things change over time. I mean, we know when we get different witnesses of a car accident the next day, they don't agree. Think 40 years and a change of language, there are going to be changes. Furthermore, the aim of the gospel composers is to preach the good news to their congregations, not to report accurate history. Mm-hmm. They're not concerned with accurate history. They're concerned with converting and encouraging their audiences.
Well, joining us now is Darrell Bach, a research professor of New Testament studies at the Dallas Theological Seminary, and he's with us from his home in Dallas, Texas. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And I know you have a different view of the Gospels.
Well, I do. I don't think we need quite the disjunction between theology and history that was just suggested, although the outline of how the Gospels were produced, I think we're in fairly substantial agreement on, that they did go through a language change, that it did take place somewhere between 40 to 70 years after, depending on which gospel we're talking about. On that, we're on agreement. But the nature of these gospel materials and how the adaptations work that were mentioned, that I also think exist, that's where the differences are.
And where's the disagreement, do you think?
Well, I think the disagreement has to do with the motivation of the adaptations and whether these stories have been changed to such a degree that the fundamental history that is reflected in the stories has been radically altered or not. My sense is that the Gospels do a pretty good job of presenting the basic outline of the story and what took place, and therefore this opposition between theology and history is not something that I see the Gospels doing. I see them working their theology with the history that they're portraying.
Okay. Here's an email question that we get from Tom Davis in Delray Beach, Florida. When Mel Gibson was asked about his subdued portrayal of Pontius Pilate, he defended his decision to do that by noting that Rome had called Pilate back twice to admonish him for brutality. Any validity to that?
Yes, in the extra-biblical accounts of Philo and Josephus, we have four incidents that are noted for us between the two of them, and in three of them there is an alteration in Pilate's intention as a result of action of those above him and those around him. The problem here with these events is that we can only date two of them with certainty. One of them happened at the very beginning of his rule, and one of them happened at the very end of his rule. In fact, it brought an end to his rule. And then the middle two, we don't know exactly where they fit in about the decade that he reigned.
Joanna Dewey, I wanted to bring you in on this point. Some critics of the film have said, well, you know, Pilate wasn't this sensitive individual as he was portrayed in the movie, but rather a rather stubborn and demonstrably cruel man.
I think he was a rather stubborn and demonstratively cruel man. That was, in fact, his job. His job was to keep the peace in Judea and transmit tribute to Rome. And Rome, on the whole, didn't care how he did it. That it was so violent that he got called a couple of times and ended up getting called means that he probably wasn't gentle. But there was no need to be gentle.
I think I agree on her description of Pilate being rather cruel, but the issue here is whether he had a completely free rein. And it's clear that he at times tried to work with the Jewish leadership and did respond sometimes to Jewish pressure, and that's really the part of the portrait here. I also disagree with the idea, not expressed by a colleague here, but sometimes said in this discussion, that Pilate's kind of whitewashed for what he does here. I don't think many of us would want a judge who, on the one hand, thinks that we're innocent and yet lets us go to our death on the other. It's a different kind of condemnation for Pilate than it is for the Jewish leadership that comes through the Gospels.
He comes off as a fairly weak character.
Yes, he does come off as weak.
A political bind.
Yeah.
I don't think he particularly was weak. And I think the Jewish leader's job, basically, was to stay in the good graces of Pilate. If they didn't, they would no longer have been leaders. So in that sense, yes, there was cooperation. But the person who was the patron was Pilate. The person who was the client who's had to stay in favor were the Jewish leaders.
But there are these other accounts that do indicate that there were times when the Jewish clients complained above his head and that it did render some effect. And so
that's true.
I don't think
I'd
he has quite the free hand that's being suggested here.
Presumably, writes Tim in San Francisco, to introduce verisimilitude into his picture, Mr. Gibson has the actor speak in Aramaic and in Latin. A Roman soldier in that place and in that time would not have known Latin, but would have spoken Koine, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, a dialect of classical Greek. Is that right, Mr. Bach?
Be Koine Greek, I think, is what he means. And yes, on this one, I think Gibson got it wrong. The two key languages would have been Aramaic and Greek.
I concur.
Yeah. Now, in terms of what the film focuses on, and the last hours of the life of Jesus Christ, do you think that Daryl Bach, that the film is an accurate representation of what we read in the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John?
I think it is a fairly accurate representation. Now, I could tick off probably a half dozen or more things where I would go, I don't think that's quite the way that it happened, but I think the general thrust and tone of what you see in the movie does connect with the biblical accounts. I made a list for beliefnet.com and counted over 70 points of contact between the biblical accounts in this movie.
And obviously, Joanna Dewey, you've not seen it, so you can't comment on that.
I actually can comment here from all the reviews and would like to. As I understand the movie, the emphasis is overwhelmingly on the suffering of Jesus, with 15 minutes on the scourging and then the long, drawn-out crucifixion. And when you actually read the gospel accounts in the narratives, it is not Jesus' suffering that is stressed. What is stressed is the humiliation, the mocking scenes, and what is also stressed, and I think Derek Bach would agree with me here, that is accord with the will of God, shown through the allusions to the Hebrew Bible and through the darkness and the signs. And so I think what the texts are concerned about is not how much Jesus suffered. He suffered less than the other people crucified with him. The gospel accounts are clear on that. Pilate was surprised he was dead so early, or in John, they didn't have to break his knees because he'd already died. And many of the other people crucified suffered far more hours, longer, even days. So I think While, yes, he's portrayed crucifixion, he has shifted the gospel stories, which do not focus on the suffering, quite drastically away from the point the gospels are making.
Daryl Bach?
Again, I think I agree with her description of the way the Gospels do this, but I think there's an explanation for it. The first is that anyone operating in the first century aware of what crucifixion involved would inherently understand what was involved in crucifixion. That's why it was so shameful. That's why the death was so difficult. She's also right that these next to Jesus probably actually suffered in terms of being on the cross longer than he did. But what the film gets right is that there was this terrible scourging before someone went to the cross, and there is this hanging feature to the way someone dies. It's not pleasant, it's not pretty, and the moment you decide that you're going to portray this event in something close to real time, it is going to, if you will, drag the story out. You can read the entire Passion account in 10 minutes. This is a two-hour movie. We know he hung on the cross for around 6 hours, if we can trust the Gospels. And so so this is a kind of in real time portrayal.
Let's get some more listeners involved, and let's hear from Chris, who joins us from San Diego.
Yes, sir.
Hi.
Saw the movie last night, and I thought it was excellent. I think Dr. Bach was correct. I think what it is one of the problems people are having so much with this movie is the fact that we're living in the year 2004. When we read the gospel accounts, often we can't imagine all the details of the sufferings that Christ went through, whereas the first century readers could. And I think it's just like for us nowadays going to the movies and seeing Saving Private Ryan, the first 10 minutes of that with the account of them storming the beach. Very graphic and very vivid.
But are you saying we have to judge it in the political context of where we are today as well as the political context of where they were at the time of Christ?
No, what I'm trying to say is that I think that people are raving about the violence being gory and graphic and everything. It is a rated R film. And we got to remember this is a 12-hour event that's condensed into 2 hours, and it's not by any means, I think, drawn out and overdone.
Mm-hmm. Joanna Dewey, is the suffering of Christ, is that central to the story of Christianity?
Yeah, I do not believe it is in the early centuries. The focus on the passion and the sufferings of Christ really doesn't come into Christian piety until the Middle Ages.
And I disagree here. I think that the issue of Jesus dying for sin, suffering for sin, even the remarks about bearing the cross and the association with the cross that's a part of that, that's in the earliest text.
The bearing the cross is actually a symbol that you will be persecuted if you follow the reign of God in the kingdom of God in this age, and it people to carry the cross are not just Jesus, but also the disciples. So that's not something limited to what Jesus did for us, but persecution if you challenge the ways of the world, which Jesus certainly did in his teaching of the reign of God.
But the modeling for that is the experience of Jesus, which is seen to be an archetypical pattern for what it is that everyone who follows him will go through. So it's in the early texts. The idea of Jesus being a ransom for many is in the early texts. So this is not just a medieval thought.
We're speaking
the emphasis on the passion as something to focus on and glory in and connect with the suffering is medieval.
We're speaking
the
with
earlier notion of what Jesus' death accomplished of the first centuries is that Jesus withstood it and that crucifixion was evil, but good overcame it in the resurrection. That Sunday, that Easter is the important thing, not the death.
That's Joanna Dewey, who is an academic dean at the Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We're also speaking with Daryl Bach, who's research professor of New Testament Studies at Dallas Theological Seminary. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. Alexander's with us from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hello, how you doing?
Okay.
I just wanted to call and comment on the film The Passion of Christ. From my understanding, the title of the film, The Passion, isn't passion in the traditional sense. It's passion, I think, the Greek or Latin derivative of suffering. And a lot of the individuals who have been calling in and a lot of the criticisms I've seen written about the film, everyone's always talking about how there's not really enough focus on Christ's message. The film is not called The Message of Christ. It's called The Passion of Christ. And Mel Gibson's trying to highlight the actual suffering that Christ went through because it was you know, some serious stuff that he went through, and people don't really understand that. And the film, basically the whole point of the film is to highlight the suffering that Christ endured. And I think people are, you know, tripping themselves up because they're wanting the film, they're almost trying to co-opt the film to mean what they want it to mean, what they think it should mean, rather than, you know, taking it for what it is. It's a film highlighting the suffering that Christ went through. And, of course, there's all kinds of, you know, imagery, you know, concerning blood in the Bible, the blood of Christ and whatnot. And the film, from what I understand, I haven't yet seen the film. I plan on seeing it today. But from what I understand, the film is full of a lot of blood. And, you know, there's no doubting the religious imagery of blood, you know, concerning the story of Jesus. And when people say that it's, you know, gratuitous use of blood and violence and all that stuff, I have to strongly disagree, because, you know, if you are a believer, it is through the blood of Christ that, you know, one attains salvation. And so it would be very, very negligent to downplay the role of the violence, you know, inherent in the last 12 hours of Jesus' life.
It's actually called The Passion of the Christ. But Darryl Bach, passion is a word that is, this sense of that word is misunderstood often.
Yes, it is. It comes from the Greek word pathos, which refers to suffering, and so it doesn't carry the connotations that it does in English.
And our general usage of that same terminology, Joanna Dewey, is in passion plays, of which I guess this could be described as, I guess, the most recent.
Yes.
Okay. Alexander, thanks very much for the call.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
And see if we get one more caller in before the break. And this is Ronnie, who's with us from Coral Gables, Florida.
Yes, my question, and in fact my comment, I don't care to see the movie as a Christian, a practicing Christian. I question the intent of Mel Gibson, because Christ moves us and teaches us to live now, to live with love, integrity, faith, forgiveness, and to earn what we in fact have by, one, accepting Christ, believing and confessing. So if one Jewish person is hurt because of this movie, if one individual is hurt because of this movie, what is the purpose? Mel Gibson will profit from this movie. The distributors will profit. But I don't hear people talking about love, integrity, faith, forgiveness.
Well, Ronnie, do you believe that the purpose of Mel Gibson and the distributors in making this movie was to inspire violence against Jews?
I don't think that's their intent. I think their intent is, one, to profit. And Christ was not about to profit. That's not what Christ is for. That's not what Christ is. Christ lives now.
Ronnie, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it. We're talking about the movie The Passion of the Christ. Of course, you're invited to join us. We're going to take a short break and continue our conversation after we come back. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about the history of the Gospels, first century Christians, all of course in the context of the new movie, The Passion of the Christ. We'll be back with Darryl Bach and Joanna Dewey in just a moment. But in addition to the four Gospels of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, from which Mel Gibson wove together his movie, there are others in the ancient world that did not become part of the Bible. And here to tell us what happened to those is Bart Ehrman. He's a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, the author of Lost Christianities, The Battles for Scriptures and the Faiths We Never Knew. He's with us from his home in Chapel Hill. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
How many other Gospels were there?
Well, we don't know how many there were. We have a couple of dozen other ones that we now have that didn't make it into the New Testament, but we can assume that there were lots more others that were destroyed or otherwise lost.
And what happened to them?
Well, some of them were declared to be heretical, so teaching false teachings about Christ, and so they were burned or otherwise destroyed.
So these were they just thought to be heretical at the time?
Some of them were, and they taught various views of Christ, which were popular in some parts of Christianity, but ended up losing out when the formers of the canon decided which books to include and which ones to exclude.
So how do we know about them then?
Well, we know about them because they're the enemies of the heretics, the people that are, I guess we would call them heresiologists. These enemies of the heretics wrote books against their opponents and described some of their writings. But we've also discovered a number of writings in modern times that were ancient gospels that have been used by one church or another that came to be excluded from the canon.
And how historically reliable are they?
Well, they're probably less historically reliable than the Gospels of the New Testament, but even the New Testament Gospels have historical problems, as some of your comments have indicated already today.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew, Mark, and Luke and John are our earliest Gospels, and they're probably the best as historical sources, but there are other Gospels that are pretty early, including a Gospel called the Gospel of Thomas and another one called the Gospel of Peter, both of which we still have.
And when were they written?
They were probably written in the early 2nd century, so probably 10 or 15 years after the Gospel of John, although some scholars date the Gospel of Thomas back to the 1st century, claiming that it was earlier even than our canonical four.
And are these taken seriously today?
Oh, they're taken very seriously for a variety of reasons. There may be some materials found in both the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Peter, for example, that are historically reliable materials that are otherwise escaped the Gospel writers of the New Testament. But also these books are taken seriously because they show us very clearly what some Christians were thinking about Christ in the early centuries after his death.
Well, hang in with us. I want to bring back our guests, Daryl Bach, a research professor of New Testament studies at Dallas Theological Seminary, and Joanna Dewey, professor of biblical studies at the Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And let's talk a little bit about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and these other Gospels, and who decided which ones got to be put into what we now know as the New Testament. Joanna Dewey?
Gradually, the leaders of the church, who were elite men, decided which ones. The first group, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were pretty well decided by consensus that churches were using them. Then there became more of a debate whether to include or others. I mean, there's a lovely story of a bishop in the 2nd century asked about the Gospel of Peter, and his first reaction is, of course, read it in church. That's what canonical basically means.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went and read it himself and thought, no, that's not quite such a good idea. I don't like some of its ideas. So in many ways, it's did the theology agree with the theology of the church leaders in the 300s?
And Daryl Bach, is this, I assume, like any other human enterprise, politics enters into who gets to tell whose story?
Yeah, eventually I think that's true. But I think in the case of the four Gospels, as Joanna mentioned, these four Gospels rose to prominence pretty early. And it wasn't just decisions in the 300s that did this. These Gospels were well established in the 2nd century. So we're talking a whole 125 years before some of the councils that finalized the process, but the Gospels were there pretty much from the point where we can trace the process, begin to trace the process.
Yes, by the late 100s, by about close to 200, I'd agree.
Yeah. And Bart Ehrman, I just wanted to ask you, if they've been finding more of these, conceivably there are still more out there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They come to be discovered every now and then. There was a new gospel that was discovered actually in a museum in Berlin, in a collection of documents that they had. They didn't realize what they were sitting on, but there was a gospel written in Coptic, an ancient Egyptian language, that that two American scholars just happened upon and published just a few years ago. A gospel that probably dates from the 2nd century that describes Christ going to his cross.
Well, Bart Ehrman, thanks very much. Appreciate it. Bart Ehrman is a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, the author of Lost Christianities, The Battle for Scriptures and the Faiths We Never Knew, and he was with us from Chapel Hill in North Carolina. And now let's get back to the phone calls, and our next caller is Tom, and Tom's with us from San Francisco.
Yes.
You're on the air, Tom. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a Roman Catholic by birth and baptism, multi-generational Irish and Italian Catholics. I was duped into seeing this film yesterday because it was Ash Wednesday. But I have to say, it was a relentless bloodbath of disproportionate emphasis on the evil of the Sanhedrin.
The Sanhedrin is the trial held by the Jewish elders.
Yes. One of the Ten Commandments is, thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor. But zealots will always ignore tenets of their faith in order to push their private prejudices. To me, Mel Gibson is like the Lenny Ray Riefenstahl of American Catholicism. Lenny Riefenstahl said, "All I did was film athletic events." She didn't admit that it was always in sunlight, the blonde, blue-eyed men were always gazing into the setting or rising sun. She didn't never admit it to emphasizing her own particular viewpoint, despite the evidence in front of her.
Well, Leni Riefenstahl also filmed Hitler's rallies at Nuremberg and other places, so I think that...
And refused to seek out, even though there's evidence that she knew about Dachau and endless suffering of the Jewish people in her. Mel Gibson invents things in this film for what he thinks or portrays as a truer relation of what really happened. They wanted to quote the Pope, whom he doesn't trust. Mel Gibson does not trust the Pope, but for financial gain, he'll quote him. However, whether it's true or not, this is as it was. Mel Gibson invents a character, this satanic character in this movie, and places him amongst the Sanhedrin while he portrays Pontius Pilate as a rational, empathetic, objective human being. Pontius Pilate was as bloody a dictator as Adolf Hitler.
Well, perhaps not as Adolf Hitler. Let's not put him in Hitler's class, Tom. But anyway, let's get back to...
At least Pontius Pilate crucified people in public. He didn't cart them off to camps so that Mel Gibson's father could one day deny that millions were slaughtered in secret.
Well, I think we would want to retain a sense of proportion here, Tom. But anyway, let's get back to the point that seems to be central to this discussion, and one of the points you raise is about raising this question about the Sanhedrin and the responsibility of the Jews. A caller brought it up just before the break as well. And Darrell Bach, that's the question of does the picture either incite or inspire or portray anti-Semitism?
I don't think so. I think that what you're seeing is a first century religious conflict that ended up in Pilate's hands, with Pilate having the responsibility for making the final call, which he did. And even though he's portrayed as doing it reluctantly, in the end, he did say yes and was responsible for the crucifixion. Both Christian and Jewish historians hold him responsible for the crucifixion. So in that sense, the movie reflects what happened, and I think that the Roman soldiers are just as responsible in this film. In fact, in some ways, more so responsible than anything the Jewish leaders are doing in this film.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. And let's get Jerry on the line. Jerry's with us from Burlington, Vermont.
Yeah, I'm very appreciative of what that gentleman just now said, and I really think that it's demonstrable already. By the way, I disagree. I think he's worse than Leni Riefenstahl, because she didn't do such a graphic thing, anti-Semitic thing, explicitly. I didn't like her, and I disliked her intently, but I don't think she was anywhere near as bad as Mel Gibson is showing himself to be. This guy is avowedly a right-wing Catholic. I mean, this fellow just before me was talking about that. He has absolutely no apology for what he's doing. I'm not too crazy about the man you have, the religious person you have on your show right now. If that can't be... Yesterday on Peter Jennings, they showed a church in the Midwest that had a sign up in front that says, "Confirmed, the Jews killed Christ." And then they had a reference to Thessalians, or however you say that. But in any case, this is already happening, and I expect you're going to see, just mark my words, you're going to see violence against Jews in the next few months, and I think he wanted it to be that way. I do. I genuinely think he wanted it to be that way, and I think a lot of apologists for him also want that. It's being seized on by anti-Semites, and it should be. I mean, that's a great propaganda film in their arsenal now.
Well, Darrell Bach, I think you probably want a chance to respond to that.
Well, I would. Anyone who tries to use this film for anti-Semitism has not understood the message of the film, and it would be an abuse of what the film is about.
Okay, Jerry, thanks very much for the phone call. Okay,
that doesn't seem to be what reality is dealing with.
Well, some people have said, Joanna Dewey, that they have called Mel Gibson a zealot. And again, you've not seen the picture. Obviously, you've read reviews of it. But that this could intentionally or not, and I don't think a lot of people question Mel Gibson's sincerity. They may question his aesthetic judgments and some of his other judgments, but not his sincerity. But do you fear that it can inspire anti-Semitism?
I think it can't help to. I would agree with Derek Bach that a few of the Jewish leaders did connive with Pilate to get rid of him, though I would say it was not primarily for religious threat. I would think it was equally political and economic. However, I do think the film, by portraying the emphasis on the Jews, does encourage the belief that has been taught in some churches that the Jews killed Jesus. And we have seen the disastrous results. And I think the results of a theology, or in this case a movie, are an important part of its message. And if what it does is encourage violence against Jews, then the movie is a bad movie, or an evil movie. I'm making a moral judgment. I am not making an aesthetic judgment.
Okay, let's see if we get one more caller in. This is Michael, who's with us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I just wanted to say it seems that the people who, I guess it was 10 or 12 years ago, were so against the Last Temptation of Christ have been the people who were really supporting the Passion, and the people who were so supportive of Last Temptation of Christ who were really railing against the Passion now. And I think, you know, it's both sides of a hypocritical coin, and the movie really should stand as whether it's a good movie or not, not, you know, whether there's some alleged anti-Semitism in it or whatever.
So just
things people think about it.
So remove the moral element from it and just look at it as a movie.
Absolutely.
Would you agree with that, Darryl Bach?
I think it's difficult to remove the moral element from the movie. I do agree with the caller that that the film needs to be assessed on its own terms, both at a artistic level as well as in terms of what it is attempting to portray. And I think it tries to do this fairly carefully by indicating the complex combination of factors that led to Jesus' death.
And clearly, Joanna Dewey, you were just speaking a moment ago that you don't think the moral element can be removed.
And I am also concerned for those who see it. I agree it is a Passion movie, but those who see it as this is the core of the Christian message, that, I think, bothers me as much as a Christian, I'm making this statement, as the anti-Semitic impact the movie may have.
Michael, thanks. I'm sorry?
Can I say one more thing?
If you keep it very short.
Yeah, at hatrack.com, Orson Scott Card has a great review of the movie.
Okay, thanks very much, Michael. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye.
And I thanked our guests today for their time. Joanna Dewey, a professor of biblical studies and academic dean at the Episcopal Divinity School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, with us from her office in Cambridge. Thank you very much, Joanna.
Thank you.
And Darryl Bach, thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
Darryl Bach, a research professor of New Testament studies at Dallas Theological Seminary. He spoke with us from his home in Dallas, Texas. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.